Wicklund.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would like to do, I have two people here to help with the testimony. Kent Allen, Chief Procurement Officer from the Department of Administration, and John Eichten from the Office of Enterprise Technology. The author's amendment incorporated some language from the Office of Enterprise Technology, amongst other things. And since it's fairly extensive, I would like to have them go through the bill because they are more familiar with the modifications to the original bill.
Okay, so just tell us if you're talking about the bill itself or the A3 amendment.
I'll turn it over.
And who's going to begin? Mr. Allen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Wicklund, members. My name is John Eichten,
for the record. Mr. Eichten, sorry.
I'm Legislative Director at the Office of Enterprise Technology. I'll just walk through the A3, the provisions relating to minute services or the Office of Enterprise Technology. Lines 1.6 through 1.15, those relate to the 2000 law, the IT consolidation law that was passed in 2011. This mandated that the chief information officer must manage and disperse appropriations for new IT projects. So this language simply clarifies that agencies must work with Minute to identify all IT costs that are included in a new project and then transfer that amount to Minute unless a transfer is deemed unnecessary by the state's chief information officer. So lines 1.2 through 1.15 are technical changes from the Department of Administration. And then lines 2.4 through 2.6, these lines add some clarifying language to the Department of Administration procurement statutes related to standards for the procurement of information technology by state agencies so that to ensure that they're usable by those who are blind or visually impaired. So Minute Services issued similar standards in 2010 that include stronger, more enforceable language, and as a result, the two different standards are required to be included in contracts and RFPs. This is duplicative and confusing. So this language simply clarifies that executive branch agencies who are subject to Minute technology standards don't need to include the admin procurement standards in their contracts. This is supported by the Federation of the Blind, the Commission for the Deaf, Deaf-Blind, Hard of Hearing, Department of Administration, and our State Technology Accessibility Advisory Committee. So lines 2.11 through 3.5, this is actually language is included in Senator Saxhog's state government omnibus budget bill, or governor's recs, and would provide Minute the authority to enter into a partnership agreement with a private entity for enhancement of the state web portal and then development of new online government services. So it would permit an online transaction convenience fee to be assessed by Minute in partnership with a private vendor, not to exceed $2 per transaction. And that revenue would be leveraged to support development of new e-government services. So lines 3.16 then through 4.10 establish an e-government advisory council, which would provide oversight of the convenience fee receipts and work with agencies and the private partner to recommend the priority of new e-government services to be developed. And so this is a model. It's in use in about 26 other states. It's proven to be very successful in growing the suite of e-government services available to the public. And through a partnership with a private entity, we feel we can leverage existing e-government services that other states have managed to put forward with very little customization required. And I would just say that as a result of the consolidation process, this is one need that we've identified as existing is an enterprise-wide strategy for development of new electronic government services. We feel that this partnership would accelerate our ability to move those services online and enhance citizens' interaction with government online and through the digital realm. So I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Eichten, it references in here different fees that in the new language, establishing a convenience fee, the fee amount, and the changes to the fee amount. Can you give me a background on that?
So the language would cap, Madam Chair, members, the language would cap the fee at $2 per transaction, but certain transactions may not call for a $2 convenience fee. It may be less than $2. And so the committee would work with agencies and this private entity to set an appropriate fee amount that would relate to the costs of development of the service and provide oversight. I'm sorry if I missed any part of your question.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Eichten, the convenience fee is then goes to, is it change into the fee amount? I mean, does it, a convenience fee is just what you expect it to be, and then it, all of a sudden it goes into what the fee amount is, and then it changes to the fee? It's confusing.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Eichten.
And members, if the fee amount were to be set at a dollar, perhaps, and through use of the service it's determined that the fee amount is not recovering the cost of development, then we may return to the committee and ask that it be raised to $1.50 perhaps, but the cap would still be in place at $2 per transaction. So in terms of the fee amount, it would be set within that $0 to $2 range through the committee.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Eichten, the fee will be determined then in the next committee or in the finance committee? Is that what you're talking? Are you bringing forward that already?
What would go to the, Madam Chair, members, what would go to the Finance Committee is the language allowing up to a $2 fee. And then on an ongoing basis through this advisory council, we would, within the $0 to $2 range, set a fee for each specific service that was developed. Some services will require more customer service, more customization than others, and that fee would be set on the higher end. Others, we may be able to repurpose an existing e-service from another state, and it would be free. So anywhere, the law would provide for a fee to be set by the council anywhere within the $0 to $2 range.
Mr. Eichten, can you give us some examples of some e-services that you'd be charging for?
One good example that's already, or a good instance of this model, Madam Chair, would be the DNR's campsite reservation website. They did not provide, the initial development for that site was done by an outside vendor. They paid for the development of the site, and then over time those costs are recouped through a transaction fee. So we would look at similar sort of e-government services. Other states have used this model to develop a state construction registry. Idaho was able to create a trucking portal. Rhode Island recently received the Digital Government Achievement Award for their e-government service site for uniform commercial code lookups. So it really would run the gamut anywhere from a mobile phone app that would allow someone to look up just the right lake that had the kind of fish they wanted to fish, the right water depth, and those are the types of services that other states have been able to provide for their citizens that we feel we could repurpose fairly easily.
Okay, any other questions? Then let's continue.
Yes, Mr. Allen would like to testify about the procurement provisions in the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair and members, my name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. The bill that we're bringing forward for your consideration would involve a number of fairly modest changes to the state procurement statutes that we think would help streamline the process, better use the technology that we've invested in, and eliminate some activities that really don't add value. If you go back to the original bill, I can kind of walk you through the sections real quickly, and if you have questions, feel free to ask. Sections 1 and 3 are really designed to allow the state to accept electronic bid responses. Historically, the procurement process has relied on paper bids and proposals, and we recently invested significant state resources in building SWIFT, which is the state's new accounting and procurement system. And through SWIFT, we can accept electronic responses, which really begins to move in the direction of reducing paperwork and so forth. We need this language to ensure that we have the authority to accept non-paper responses. The sections involve what is public information. I want to assure you that we're not changing what's public and non-public information. We're simply allowing the mechanism of electronic submissions. Section 2 is kind of an interesting one. There are a couple of instances in which resident vendors receive preferences under state procurement laws. And one would assume that resident vendors are exclusively Minnesota businesses, and I suspect that actually was the intention. But the way resident vendors have been defined in the law, that hasn't been crystal clear. And we've actually had some non-state businesses argue that we should be considering them as resident vendors. So what we're attempting to do here would be clarifying the definition of resident vendors so that it really is limited to those businesses that operate in Minnesota and pay taxes in the state of Minnesota. An example of the sort of preference that a resident vendor gets would be in the case of a tie bid. The state awards a tie bid to a resident vendor. Obviously, we'd want those to be the vendors that operate in the state of Minnesota. Section 4 eliminates a paper-based report.
Just a minute, Mr. Allen. Rep. Senator Scalzi.
To this point, and thank you for bringing that up. Thank you, Ms. Chair. The resident vendor. And we've had discussions in the past regarding a vendor, a printer who lived in Minnesota who was losing printing jobs to somebody in Wisconsin. But the portal person who took his job then sent it over to a printer in Wisconsin. Would this take care of that problem?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator, it would not take care of that instance. It really is only going to be helpful in a handful of cases where state law authorizes a preference or advantage to be given to a Minnesota vendor. And frankly, there aren't too many instances where we're able to do that. And this is might be more than you want to know for purposes of this bill, but in most cases, if Minnesota gives a preference to a Minnesota vendor, 40 or so of the other states will penalize Minnesota vendors. And this is really just covering those instances where that's not a problem.
Wow. Okay, proceed, Mr. Allen.
Thank you. Section 4 would eliminate a paper-based report, but it won't eliminate the report until the Commissioner of Management and Budget has certified that the same information is available online. Mm-hmm. Section 5 eliminates paperwork anytime the state intends to contract for a service valued at under $5,000. Currently, every time the state contracts for a service at any dollar level, the agency is required to fill out a form saying that there are no state employees that can do the work. And below the $5,000 level, that really has the ramification of that has just been a lot of paperwork that really isn't adding value to the process. Section 6 is proposing to raise the one bid level from $2,500 to $5,000. This is the level at which state agencies need to more formally solicit competitive proposals or bids. This amount has not been raised since 1998, so it really hasn't reflected inflation or the changes in the value of money since that time. And again, we think we could eliminate some relatively low-value tasks by raising that amount. And then lastly, Section 7 and 8 are instances where current statutes require publication of advertisements for certain types of work in the state register. Most references to advertising in the state register had been eliminated previously, and the intent is not to fail to advertise, but not to require that particular mechanism as the only lawful way to advertise. So for the sake of consistency and with the full support of the state register, we're asking you to consider eliminating that requirement. With that, I'm very happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? And the format of the e-government advisory council meets all of our standards and requirements. Did you have a look at that, Ms. James?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. As it appears in the A3, it meets the guidelines.
Any questions? Okay. Then Senator Wicklin.
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion to pass Senate file number 804 and be referred to?
Finance.
To finance?
Yeah.
Okay.
Senator Wicklund moves that Senate Bill 804 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Is Senator Marty in the room?
Thanks for your time.
Is Senator Hoffman in the room? They're probably sending for them. He was? Senator Marty was?
Just a small word.
Senator Hoffman was?
I can text him.
And Senator Metzen. Senator Johnson, did you say you had a quick bill while we're while we're looking for them? Is that your 324? All right.
Madam Chair, members, Senate File 324 is a bill that will ask our pension public pension plans to report any evidence of theft or misuse of public funds. I spoke to Senator Anderson, and I said I thought it would be a bill that most everyone would be able to agree with me on this matter, and hopefully you will find it that to be that way.
Ms. Allen, did this come out of some task force or something from the state auditor?
Oh, for the record, Rose Hennessy Allen, pension director at the state auditor's office. This one, this bill hasn't come out of our working group. It's a bill that we've wanted to bring forward for a few years and just think it's a good, good government bill. It would provide accountability of pension plan administrators and to their members and the public and help to safeguard pension plan assets. So we just think it would be a good change.
Is this bill going on its own, or is it eventually going to go supposed to go on the Pension Commission bill?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, this bill is going on its own, so it wouldn't cause the pension bill to go through any extra committees.
Judiciary, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Johnson, or your testifier, Ms. Allen, what are some of the unlawful actions that you're concerned about that we're having to put this into statute?
Ms. Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator, currently local units of government, so cities, towns, and counties, report unlawful actions to our office, and some examples of that would be misuse of funds, theft. Occasionally, we have public pension plans that have voluntarily reported that to our office. Luckily, it has not occurred very often, but every once in a while, we have reports of theft of public pension plan assets. This bill would require that that be reported to us.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Allen.
Senator Anderson.
I would think it'd be a natural thing that most public officials should, if they find something unlawful, that would be just a natural thing to do that. But is there a penalty if they don't do this?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Ms. Allen.
Our office certifies the public pension plans as being eligible for fire state aid or police state aid. So if there's a failure to report and we became aware of that, it could jeopardize our ability to certify them for state funding.
Any questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Johnson?
I would move that Senate File 324 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor, I guess.
Judiciary Committee has requested
Oh,
it.
Judiciary did. That's okay, right. I forgot
everything.
About that. Sorry about that.
Because it has to do with theft, embezzlement, unlawful use of funds.
Senate Judiciary.
All right. Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 324 be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right. Now, Senator Marty has disappeared again, so Senator Hoffman. 640. Senator Hoffman, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here. This is our second stop
first starting in jobs. This is the bill that we're looking at to hopefully get through here and move on. Madam Chair, I would like also to offer, there's an Amendment A1 that should be.
Do we already have the amendment?
Madam Chair and members,
Ms. James.
I believe it's the A2 that Senator Hoffman would like to move. And if you don't have copies, we can get copies.
Madam Chair, my glasses need to be fixed. It is A2. Thank you for the clarification.
And this is, what's the, nope, that's not it.
Madam Chair, Senate file number 640.
Okay, we don't have the amendment, so why don't you go ahead and talk about the bill, and then we'll get the amendment copy.
I will basically, thank you, Madam Chair. What this does is it establishes a trade advisory council to assist the governor and legislature regarding government procurement agreements of the United States trade agreements. And this was something that folks believe that trade policy, not just tariffs and import quotas, but among other things, you know, it would allow Minnesota to become to help our economy with jobs. And one of the things that I used at the first stop in jobs was that several other states have trade advisory groups, and Maine, for example, put one together and helped trade agreements that they it was especially retaining an industry called New Balance Shoes, and that's the last company that manufactures athletic shoes in the United States. So a little plug for that work. The members of the group, to the establishing a Trade Policy Advisory Council, because of the importance of a trade council, it's believed that the folks that want to be part of it, that are going for this, are saying that they would do so without cost. So there is no cost and no payment being received. Rather, they think it's such an important piece of Minnesota to do what's right for Minnesota in creating jobs and allow us to work in the international trade that's crucial to Minnesota business. It's an important council to have. And so did you get the A2 amendment, Madam Chair?
No, it's coming.
Okay. So I'll just run through the sections. Section 1 just establishes the Trade Policy Advisory Council, again, to advise and assist. Number 2, the membership. What it really looks at is the folks on the street that are really doing the work. We have and you'll see in the amendment, in the last stop in jobs, we actually added two different agriculture groups to be part of that as well. But 8 members appointed by the governor, 2 senators, 2 representatives of the economic deed or designee, and the commissioner of agriculture of designee to be part of it. It's a 14-member group and 2-year terms in Subdivision 3. And then requires the commissioner in Subdivision 4, Madam Chair, to provide the council meeting space and then admin services to the council. So it's in
Senator Marty, don't leave because we're almost done. We don't want to pass over you again. Okay, I'm sorry.
You're fine, Madam Chair. Thank you. Subdivision 5 is just the first meeting beginning a council by September 15th, 2013. And the commissioner deed will convene that first meeting by December 15th of 2013 and act as chair until the council, 14 members, elected chair at its first meeting. With me today, I'll just go through 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. There's no compensation, I said earlier. Talk about a gift from people that really care about jobs in Minnesota. And then the duties will be described as the council. There's going to be a report that's submitted to the chairs of the committees with primary jurisdiction over jobs in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And then finally, the council, we're going to sunset it 2020, January 1st, 2020. Madam Chair.
It must be stuff that's in your other amendment that we're waiting for, because we don't have that in front of us.
All right. But. Madam Chair, with me, as long as we're waiting on that, is Josh Wise from the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition. And I'd like him to talk a little bit more about
that. Mr. Wise, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Josh Wise. I'm the director of the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition. I'll keep my remarks brief, as Senator Hoffman summarized the bill pretty well. This is reauthorizing a group that was established in 2008. Because of the structure of the group in 2008, there were no requirements for it to meet, and there were no requirements for it to produce a report. It was also pretty heavy on state agencies with not as much input from the public.
So there was an advisory committee already, and you're restructuring it?
It was established in 2008. It sunset in 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're reestablishing it in a form that we think will be much better equipped to evaluate trade policy and its effect on Minnesota. International trade policy does have quite a powerful effect on Minnesota. The state is fairly limited in what we can do. However, we think it's worthwhile that we be analyzing and studying everything that's within our power to make sure that Minnesota can compete in the global economy with standards that reflect Minnesota values. So basically, in the reconstituted forum, we've put members of groups that have a really vested stake in making sure trade policy works for Minnesotans, and with the addition of a couple of commissioners who have specific expertise relating to trade policy. So we would really appreciate the committee's passage of the bill. Thank you.
Any questions from members on the concept of the bill? Senator Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I have a question about why is that we need an advisory group to do this? Why is that the governor, why just don't do this? Why do we need a group?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Rae, Minnesota currently runs around a $12 billion deficit right now in non-recession years regarding trade. Despite record exports in recent years, the trade policy is the third rail of our economic development policy. And we believe that we can't do meaningful economic development if our business and industry is constantly at risk of moving overseas. This group is going to be that window that will be able to be the voice of jobs in Minnesota and hopefully help provide advice and assistance and advice to the policymakers like us and the governor about what's important for trade in Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may follow up. Senator Hoffman, I want you to know that we have had multiple meetings on this issue. I have been part of some of these meetings with some of the consuls from Latin America, and a former director of trade policy with the Obama administration was here to meet with the former director of the trade office, who is now the commissioner, and we have ample evidence that we should be doing this. We know how to do it, and this administration just needs to go ahead and move and do it. So I intend to support your effort, and I hope that after we hear from this committee that we actually should do it, maybe we can get some more information as to what are some of the more, you know, immediate options that we have, but I think that we are behind in this area, and I appreciate that you're trying to move us somehow, but I do think that we know how to do it. I just wish we didn't have to put groups to tell us what to do.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres, thank you. I echo that same wish. You know, let's move it. Let's move it now. You know, I don't want to quote somebody, but get her done. You know, I mean, that's the thing that you want to do. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Hoffman, it appears the Xerox machine is not cooperating, so I would like to I'm just going to set your bill aside, and we'll take care of it for you. I assume that I don't hear any opposition unless it's coming right now.
Madam Chair.
Is this it right now? Oh, okay, it's coming right now. Senator Hall.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, two things. Are there other groups out there right now doing a similar, or is there no one out there? And secondly, in the group that was a sunset, did they not have any financing as part of their group? Because I see you have none now.
Right. Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, Senator Hall, I'm going to have Josh. He has a good history on that.
Before we do that, I'd just like us to adopt the A2 amendment, which is the author's amendment. Just so you have it in front of you. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Right. Mr. Wise.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hall. There are a number of groups who independently are analyzing the impact of trade. The Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition is a coalition of about 60 organizations. But there's not been a coordinated effort to make real concrete recommendations to the state because – you know, trade policy in its nature is, you know, done internationally with the federal government being the one negotiating the treaties. that really takes up a lot of our time, and there's not really a whole lot of capacity to be looking at the micro effects in the state and in local communities, and so that's what this group would be getting at. To the second part of your question, no, there was no funding provided in its previous iteration.
Okay, Ms. James, does this also meet with our standards in terms of an advisory council?
Madam Chair and members, yes, as amended by the A2, this group should meet the guidelines.
Okay. Sure.
Yes, Senator Hall.
I didn't notice it. Is there a sunset on this? Or
there
does
is.
It just,
it's January 1st, 2020 on 2.31. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? This has to go to the Rules Committee. You go to the Rules Committee whenever you put legislators on a board. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, just looking at the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition handout and reacting to some of the comments made by the representative. Sorry, I don't have your name in front of me. I apologize. It seems as if just maybe you can enlighten me on kind of the bent of what's going on here. What sorts of things would be done in order to rectify trade imbalances and job loss, as well as the ability of local governments to, quote, unquote, rectify the issue?
Madam Chair,
Senator
Peterson, I'm going to let Josh, I'll follow up with a comment from Josh after that. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Peterson. pardon me. As I understand what you're asking, the question is, how do we make trade more fair? How do we make Minnesota more competitive? Is that more or less correct?
Specifically, thank you, Madam Chair. Specifically, what types of things are we going to do to, in quoting the handout, correct trade imbalances and job loss and, quote, unquote, allowing local governments to rectify the issue?
Sure.
Mr. Weiss.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson. We're largely at the mercy of the federal government when it comes to establishing trade policy. Now, we can advocate for better rules. For example, when it comes to government procurement, the state actually has some leeway as to signing on to the chapters that the federal government negotiates. It's one of the few things we actually do have leeway on. And were we to do that, it would limit the things that we as a state could do in terms of promoting economic development. For example, buy Minnesotan provisions or buy American or, requiring some sort of renewable energy standard, et cetera, et cetera. We would be limited by the terms of that procurement agreement. There are provisions in trade agreements which allow foreign corporations to sue countries and other local governments for what are called barriers to trade, where they're able to sue for future expected profits. By having an advisory group in place, by making sure we're doing a full, analysis, we're able to at least be advocating to the federal government for what's best in terms of making sure that Minnesotans are able to determine their economic development agenda the way that we see fit.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Senator Peterson, that's the other thing, too, is, the trade treaties, there's that simple leeway. And the best example that shoots out for me is what happened in Maine with New Balance shoes. They were able to really advocate on behalf of keeping jobs in Maine and keeping that there. And it was something that was just a partial part of that. And I think that's important for us as we're looking forward, especially with adding to the chapter. If we have something that says Minnesota made, it's allow us to then negotiate our congressional delegations as well. It gives us a little bit of room to help advocate through them as well. So that's what we're asking for.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, or to your testifier, what were some of the accomplishments that the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition came up with as far as in the last year since it's been established?
Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson. Are you referring to the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition, or the Trade Policy Advisory Group, which is the last iteration?
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. says the legacy of the current free trade policy in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
What were the accomplishments of the policy that you guys worked on?
So the question was, you're asking about the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition.
Right.
Mr. Weiss.
Well, the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition exists to promote trade agreements that benefit all Minnesotans and all people. We're a nonprofit organization, like I said, a coalition of about 60 organizations. So we find that, what we do a lot of is opposing free trade policy that's taking place on the federal level. It would be a very long conversation to debate the merits of free trade policy, we exist as an education and advocacy organization.
So, Madam Chair, are there any victories that you can claim as far as the free trade coalition, as far as some of the free trade agreements that came about?
Mr. Weiss.
I suppose if you want to, we could talk about, ensuring that WTO rules were not extended to cover services, government services at the state and local level. That was definitely something we were a part of a few years ago. Ensuring that the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which would have been very regressive both for the United States and developing economies did not come into pass. We have not typically worked on a lot of local policy, so it's really been sort of connecting Minnesotans with the global movement for trade policy that benefits local communities, workers, farmers, consumers, et cetera.
Okay, Senator Hall.
Madam Chair and Mr. Weiss, under the same type of question, we did have a group, an advisory group. Can you claim any victories or things that you did during that time you had that group?
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, as I said in my testimony, because of the structure of the group, as it was originally constituted, there was no requirement to meet. There was no requirement to produce a report. And so the group, in our opinion, was pretty ineffective. I think that's something we can all agree on, which is why we're advocating that it be passed in this new form. The goal is for it to be effective and to actually have some victories. It depends on what you want to call a victory, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that we're, this is a fairly long game, and I don't know what we would necessarily define as a victory.
Senator Hall.
Well, I'm just concerned that you've got a volunteer group here. And in the past, they were volunteer, but they didn't have a structure that made them come to meetings. So now you set meetings that they are supposed to be at. I'm not sure that, does a lot, too, if they haven't got the passion for what they want to do. I question whether we should just put a group together unless it's we've seen some data that it gets done, and we're extending this out to 2020. That's, quite a few years. 7 years to extend it. I wouldn't mind extending it, a couple years to test it. But if things aren't getting done, then why keep this? You might as well keep Sunset in.
Mr. Weiss.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall. The idea is that in this reconstituted form, the people who are on the advisory council are the ones who have a vested stake in making sure that this group meets and this group produces a report. It's structurally, it's quite different from the way it existed before, which was it was basically members of the state government who were the voting members of the council. And because there was no requirement for them to meet, they didn't have to. But even if they had met, there's definitely the possibility that they would have been, advocating for their own best interest within state government. By having it outside members as the voting members, by having people who we know have a very vested interest in making sure that, we have solid trade policy here in Minnesota, that's why we think it'll be effective in future years. So It's designed to be more effective.
This is why we've really, over the years, developed a real structure for these advisory councils with real kind of responsibility, because we found that sometimes they weren't really very effective. Why did we bother to do it? If you didn't have a chair, if you didn't have regular meeting times, if you didn't have some accountability, some sunset. So I think you bring up some really good issues that hopefully this will be more effective this go around.
Yep,
absolutely.
Okay, so can I hear any motions?
I move.
Okay, Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate Bill 640 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Rules Committee.
Madam Chair.
Any other discussion? Madam Chair, who's the Madam Chair? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it seems Senator Hoffman, just from my estimation here in the short time we've talked about this bill, that this trade council really has kind of a decidedly anti-trade objective and protectionist objective. I mean, if you look at the membership listing here for the Fair Trade Coalition, I understand those aren't exactly the same thing here, but talking about preferences and what the desired outcomes are, the Fair Trade Coalition doesn't I don't even think has one representative of business on here. It looks like mostly labor, few social justice ministry outfits, some conservation and environmental groups. Just, you know, for the record, I mean, I think this trade policy advisory group is really designed to get at a particular worldview that maybe isn't shared by universally by the public. That's all I have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman?
Madam Chair, thank you. The coalition is separate from the advisory council, so I'm having a hard time, Madam Chair, understanding the germaneness behind that statement. I understand where you're coming from. If you look at what we have in here, we have family farmers that are part of this. You know, we put in there specifically. And what we know in Minnesota, agriculture is a huge, huge issue, a huge benefit for our state. So it's completely separate, Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, from that. Duly noted on that, but I just wanted to make sure that we're not mixing apples and apples here. Thank you.
So you have two representatives from business and industry. You have a representative from an organization focused on international trade. You have senators and House members from both the majority and the minority, a couple commissioners, and some environmental interests, and a couple of people from organized labor. So it seems like there was an attempt to make kind of a balanced group.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's what we wanted to do. And these people want to advocate for jobs in Minnesota, and that's what we've been hearing for the last few years, is what are we going to do to make sure that we're leveling the playing field? And this is a great attempt to finally move in something forward. So thank you.
Okay, the motion is by Senator Torres Ray to approve Senate File 640 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. All right, Senator Marty, sorry. And the bill was sent to rules. Yeah, in between. You'll take a while on this bill.
Who's going to take
a while? So Senator Wicklund is. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 889 is the DNR Omnibus Policy Bill, and there are a number of provisions that relate to rulemaking provisions, and I assume that's the area that the committee wants to focus on. Bob Meyer, DNR's legislative liaison, here to go through those particular provisions, perhaps. And I do have an amendment to suggest. It wouldn't be author's amendment in the sense it's already been through another committee, but to address some of the concerns related to one of the rulemaking portions. So maybe we have Mr. Meyer go first.
Testimony
Madam
first,
Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And this bill is before you today to deal with some of the rulemaking provisions and rulemaking exemptions that are in this legislation. Section 1 of the bill deals with federal compliances for the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it would provide with the Commissioner of Natural Resources the authority to establish by written order, what we call a commissioner's order, policies for the use and operation of other power-driven mobility devices as defined in the Code of Federal Register 28, Section 35.104. This will allow us the ability to update these these rules. They have the effective rules, basically, within the department. It will allow us to amend these procedures as the Americans with Disability Act changes. So it just operates more effectively and efficiently. What this is, it's like, for example, a segue. A person with disabilities to be able to use a segue on a bike trail, the Willard Munger State Trail or the Gateway Trail, to use a power-driven mobility device on a WMA or wildlife management area for hunting or within a state forest. So this will give us the authority to amend our rules by commissioner's order for those purposes. The next section of the bill, I believe, members, is Section 10 that deals with rulemaking. And what we're asking for here, you'll see the language beginning on 5.25. Well, first, let me take a step back. This section deals with wildlife rehabilitative professionals and actually specifically non-resident wildlife rehabilitation professionals coming in from out of state to help clean up loons, for example, from an oil spill. Right now, we have language that prohibits non-residents from doing so. What we're saying is that we'll, notwithstanding rules adopted under this section relating to wildlife rehabilitation permits, non-resident professional wildlife rehabilitators with a federal rehabilitation permit may possess and transport wildlife affected by oil spills. So we're just asking to exempt the rules from that. And then there's a section in the bill that actually gives us a good cause rulemaking exemption for that. Section 11 of the bill modifies language from 2010, exempting this rulemaking from 14.125, which states a rule has you only have 18 months to do a rulemaking. This is a Mississippi River Critical Area Rulemaking Authority. This is a very comprehensive process that we used, and we ran out of time because of the public process that we were using. So we ran out of went over 18 months. So you'll see that sometimes with these types of rules. The language on 5.33 retroactively changes that back to 2009. Section 12 of the bill is very similar. You'll see language on 7.5 to 7.7 that states, notwithstanding Minnesota statutes 14.125 and 128, the authority to adopt these rules does not expire. This is for the shoreland ordinance rulemaking provisions. Section 13 is the one that conforms to rulemaking authority. It gives us a good cause rulemaking exemption in 14.388 related to that non-resident wildlife rehabilitation language we just spoke of. And then Section 14 allows us the authority to update our rules relating to paddle boards. These are the big surfboard type watercrafts that people are using a lot of, and basically it gives us the rulemaking authority so you don't have to put your MN numbers, your boat registration numbers on these things. Our officers wouldn't be able to see them anyway since they are flat. The numbers would be on the top of them. So it just makes sense to allow us to adopt the rules that way, Madam Chair.
That's it.
And that's the rulemaking provisions contained within the bill.
Thank you. Senator Marty, did you want to discuss the amendment next, or do you want to...
Madam Chair, there's an A4 amendment, which was because these two sections that the Mississippi River Critical Area Rules and the Shoreland Rules had big progress made, but there were sometimes contentious processes, and because of funding and everything else, we don't know exactly how long it'll take, but some of the groups are very concerned this will drag on and on. So we're requiring them report back next year on how the progress they're making. I have a feeling the biggest impact factor on that is funding for completing the rules. But I think this is helpful. I think as chair of one of the committees that would receive this notice, I think we want to track it to make sure it's not dragging on forever.
Madam
so
Chair.
I would encourage that to be adopted.
Madam Chair, I would move the A4 amendment.
Okay. Senator Scalzi moves the A4 amendment. Are there any questions or discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, there may be some people who wish to speak with concerns about the rulemaking things. And I also have a letter I could distribute if you want from a number of fish and wildlife groups, resort owners, conservation groups, and so on. in support of the rulemaking process.
I'm sorry, there's a correction that needs to be made to the A4 amendment, and it is to change on line 1.2, page 8, after line, it should be 4 instead of 54, and on the A4 amendment. So I'm sorry,
so
please tell me the, it's, okay, do we need to re, or she can just move the change. Okay. And then we can just vote on that change. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment to the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? That motion passes. And now are we complete with that? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Before we bring up other testifiers, I just want to state for the record, the two rulemakings that are added to this bill are we're allowing to be reopened. We're highly participatory processes, and that was required. That's why we expired the 18-month rulemaking process to update the shoreland rules, which deal with from the high water mark up. Statewide, we took a lot of time and a lot of conversation statewide, a lot of stakeholder groups. Likewise with the critical area rule, and we're committed to doing so. That's why we're asking for the exemption. And it's just important to note that as the public water resources continue to decline and funds to local and state governments to administer these statewide programs are reduced, it's important now more than ever to have standards that clearly protect key resources and are easier and less costly to administer. To this end, the DNR has identified opportunities to further improve the draft shoreland and Minnesota River critical area standards guided by the following principles: better protection for riparian areas and water quality, improve ease of administration for both the local government units and the DNR, take advantage of restoration opportunities through redevelopment, consider information and stakeholder concerns from recent rulemaking processes, and continued stakeholder involvement as we move forward. You'll hear from folks that they're concerned about the onerousness of these rules, the impacts, the undefined impacts that may come about. We need to redo these rules so they're easier to administer, less costly, because we aren't going to have as many staff as we do at the state or local levels into the future. It's just a fact of life. And that we're guaranteed protections into the future for these critical areas or the shorelands of the lakes and waters of the state that everybody loves and enjoys. So, Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to put that on our record. We're committed to work with all stakeholders to develop a rule that will work not only now but into the future and be less costly and more effective to administer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I have listed Annalee Garlitz. Is she here?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Can we give testimony, ask questions of this testifier? Or?
Sure. Go ahead. And
okay.
Annalee,
you
can take a place there, and we'll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, why couldn't we accomplish what we're supposed to do in 18 months?
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the previous rule or the new rule authority are you referring to?
The previous rule.
There's a lot of complicating factors with that. The public meetings that we had outstate and then the approval processes that are required within the administration is frankly where it kind of fell apart. Some deadlines were not met within the previous administration and thus causing our rulemaking to lapse.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, well, when did this, you said 18 months ago this rule was put into effect? The thing that you said that we were now reopening it again back to 2009?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chairman, members, the first authority we received from the Shoreland Rule was in 2007. We started working on it in 2007. Our authority, I believe, was granted to us shortly thereafter. But as we go through the process, you develop the sonar. We had a lot of public meetings on those things. But then it comes into the administration for approval and signature by the governor. And that, Madam Chair, was members where since it didn't get signed off at its last step, the rulemaking was lapsed. So we had our process completed. We were waiting to publish some documents, and at the end of the last administration, that did not come to fruition.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
So, Mr. Meyer, what makes you think it's going to be better this time?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, I believe that we will be able to get those authorities and meet the deadlines at this point in time.
Senator Peterson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not interested in debating the merits of the expanded rulemaking authority. I just have two questions. Is there a fiscal note for the expanded rulemaking authority on its way?
Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, this bill will need to go to Environment Finance because of other provisions within it. We are working on a fiscal note. We can do the work now without additional money, and that's one of the reasons why we need the 14.125 exemption. It will take longer for us to do. We will not be able to do it within 18 months without money to do so. But we can get it done without appropriations, but it will take longer. So it's going to be how much do we want to fund this to get it done, or do we just get it done within our existing workload? So we will discuss those issues within the fiscal note for the Environment Finance Division.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Marty. So the Madam Chair and Senator Marty, this bill is being referred from this committee to Environment Finance.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Meyer. I looked at those that were supporting you or this cause, and I questioned, I don't know if Joel Carlson is here from the Minnesota Congress of Resorts. I see a Jeff Forrester, Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. I kind of wondered about why they would support something like this if they're here. And then I see Don McMillan, Outdoor Heritage, Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'm not sure. Don passed away, didn't he? So, are any of them here that would testify or why they would?
I'm told that this? Vern Wagner from Anglers or Habitat is here. I'm not sure if others are. Jeff Mr. Bostic or others.
Jeff Forrester is here.
Okay. I don't see anybody stepping forward.
Okay. So is there, Madam Chair, is there opposition to this? Maybe we should just hear that first.
I believe we have a testifier who is going to testify in opposition. And Annalie Garlitz, if you could please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And we do have some concerns about moving forward with shoreland rulemaking. I would like to start by thanking the Department of Natural Resources. They've spent a considerable amount of time, their staff have, talking to the county commissioners and different planning and zoning staff to try to help us understand what the DNR might think about moving forward with these rules. And I think what it comes down to is that right now counties, as required by the current rules, are already required. We are required. We have shoreland ordinances in place, and in many cases, they are more restrictive than the state standards. These ordinances cost money. We have to adopt, we have to administer, and we have to enforce these shoreland rules. And our concern is, without knowing what the DNR is going to move forward on adopting, and this is why we have been engaged in these discussions and plan on keeping that line of communication open, but without knowing exactly what they're going to change, and I understand sometimes rules don't always work like that, we have some considerable costs about, or concerns about what these costs, what these changes might mean in dollars to counties. As Mr. Meyer noted, DNR has limited staff. We used to rely on those staff to ask questions of and to consult with when we're issuing permits. They're not able to do that anymore. And I also have limited staff within my counties. So we're kind of bracing ourselves to see what other requirements might come out of these rules. And that's why we want to state, we'll still certainly keep talking with DNR, but those are my concerns, are the costs. And quite frankly, one other thing that the county commissioners have brought up is, are we redoing the rules just to redo them? What are the outcomes that we're going to gain? What are the environmental benefits that we're going to gain by redoing these rules? And so that's some of the discussions that we've been having and some of the questions we've been asking.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, what was your last name? The last testifier?
Garlitz.
Garlitz. Are the counties not doing an adequate job? Is that why this is coming about? And maybe I can ask Mr. Meyer that also. So you can go first.
Madam Chair and Senator.
And this is Ms. Garlitz.
Counties, in fact, I've just been trying to put together a handout to give to people about this, and it's not quite finished yet. But in most cases, I think that there are a significant number of counties that have updated, that have even more restrictive ordinances than the state mandates that they have. And most of them have been done from 2007 on up as recently as 2012. So counties are keeping on top of the ordinances, we're enforcing them, but also the dollars that we get from the state are quite minimal, and the dollars that counties are expending on these are already quite a lot. I have Aitkin County, top of my list, for instance. The estimated cost to administer, enforce, and implement their shoreland rules is $260,000. They get $10,700 from the state to do so. So those, and I have a list of almost all of the counties at this point of the cost. So that's what we're looking at, is we get these mandates to do this. And in many cases, we're going above and beyond what the state is setting as minimum requirements. And we're also kind of wondering, if we're doing something wrong, by all means, let's try to address that. Let's change the rule. Let's update it if there's science behind it. And we will put that into our ordinances. But that's what we're asking for, is some of that proof.
Any other questions? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Hall.
I had asked Mr. Meyer to respond to that also, if he would.
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. And while there are some counties that are doing a better job than the state, there are some that just have the minimum standards as well. And as I stated previously, our goal is to help reduce that administrative cost at the end of the day. And we fully understand the concerns the counties have about upgrading or redoing, reauthorizing their shoreland standards, and we're committed to work with them, preparing draft ordinances that they can pick up and utilize. At the end of the day, the protections that we have are outdated in some areas. The shoreland management ordinances were redone last in 1989. There's been we had a huge growth on seasonal recreational property, and now we've had a decline. We have an opportunity here to kind of reset the ordinances together without trying to chase our tail around. Take a deep breath, look at how they all fit together, look at how the administration should work, who should be doing what, and how can we save money at the end of the day. We recognize that the concerns that the counties have, and we spent, as Ms. Garlett stated, a considerable amount of time this summer talking with the counties about that. I think I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth, but the fear of the unknown is always, especially as you go into rulemaking, a big thing. But we are committed as the Department of Natural Resources to work with all the stakeholders to make sure at the end of the day this does make it better and more efficient and provide a greater level of protection.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall. Mm-hmm.
You know, I can see some of that. The other side that I look at, though, is you've got counties. They're smaller groups, and they've got different needs and different understandings for their area. The northern Minnesota boundary waters, or up in Cook County, is real different than down in near Marshall. And I would rather see local elected officials be responsible for what they're doing. I just think that's a better way of work.
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, I would hope that some of that will come to light within this new rule as well. That local flexibility, that local control and decision making needs to be reflective as well.
And Madam Chair, I just want to again state that conservation and fish and wildlife groups and resort folks and so on, they understand they need they have different situations, and they're supporting this moving forward. Again, the rules have not been redone for 20 some years, and again, we had a lot more resorts. We had a lot fewer private properties, cabins on lakefronts, and we have a lot of changes now. I think that this is something that will be worked out. They were making good progress on the rules. They ran out of time, and so they've sat idle for several years.
Okay. Welcome. Introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle from Larkin Hoffman. I represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. I've commented to Senator Marty previously that we have concerns with this bill. We just learned about the amendments that were made in committee Friday afternoon, and perhaps Mr. Meyer spoke with folks that I represent, but I'm not aware that that conversation occurred, so we're responding on short notice, so I apologize for that. Two bow tie wearers ought to be able to agree on things like this, but today at least we do not. I echo what Ms. Garlitz testified to a few minutes ago. We went through the process, for the critical area process, for quite an extensive period of time. There are lots of stakeholders who are interested in this issue. I'm guessing that a lot of the private development community does not know about this rulemaking exemption that's being requested. But for my client, there is a strong concern that this is an open-ended, undefined process yet again. And if the agency has changes that it proposes, it should go through a normal rulemaking notice process so that stakeholders have a chance to review and comment. Those are my comments, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. And the gentleman who just came to the table, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, Madam Chair. My name is Vern Wagner, and I'm Vice President of Anglers for Habitat here in Minnesota. We're a statewide organization, primarily fishing, that, and our goal is aquatic habitat. And we have been supporting this shoreline rule package now for over 10 years. We thought we had it done. We were ready to order the T-shirts and rent the hall and get a polka band. And for lack of a signature, it didn't get done. But it's been done. It was done, and it was accepted, and was ready to go, and it didn't. And now all of a sudden, as we try to bring it back, we're facing some of the same issues that we did in the past. The issue is, for us, that there is a relationship between shoreline development and loss of aquatic habitat. When shoreland is developed, the natural buffers, the vegetation, the emergent vegetation gets reduced. And in many cases, this is not an issue because you have a nice rocky shoreline, and you really couldn't, you know, turn it into a golf course lawn if you wanted to, you know. But the property that's becoming available now for development is the less desirable land. It's the marshy, cattail, soft stuff that has sat for 50 years and now all of a sudden is being developed. So we're looking for some uniform statewide standards that can help guide developers in what they're doing. I want to give you an example, my own personal example. I was up in a small cabin up on a lake in Morrison County. It was a mom-and-pop cabin, and in front of me were mom-and-pop cabins. All of a sudden, one of my neighbors somehow got permission from the county to put a McMansion on his small lot. Didn't even had to get a variance for the septic system, had to get a variance for the setback, had to get a variance for the width of the cabin. And we were all amazed because we couldn't even add on to our cabins. We'd go to the county board, and we couldn't add on. But aha, all of this was done by the developer in conjunction with the county board. And then the guy ringed it with security lights that came on automatically at night. And all of a sudden, I found myself living next to a Walmart. And it wasn't my experience. So we're suggesting that this shoreline land development package be put back into play. It will be different from what we had 10 years ago, and I believe that it takes into account the county's needs in this situation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner. Is there any other questions? Is Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, why wasn't the previous rulemaking 18-month final deal signed?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, I do not know. I think there were several signatures along the way that had to be done. There are all these timelines it had, and they had 18 months. I don't think they were 100% done. They were pretty close, and for whatever reason, I don't know, it didn't get done. Maybe Mr. Meyer could fill you in more on that. But both of these two cases, the Mississippi River one and the Shoreland ones, they overshot the time.
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the timeline of that signature would have been the summer, the last summer of the Pawlenty administration. At that point in time, the governor, just to be very frank, was closely examining everything he was signing, what impacts it might have, and what decisions people may look at that are being made from decisions. And the signature was never placed on the documents to have the rulemaking go forward.
Okay, any other questions? Could I have a motion? Senator Wicklund. And goes to finance. Thank you. Senator Wicklund moves that Senate file 889 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. Any other comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hand. Plus, all those opposed? The motion prevails on a vote of 7-4.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Metzen is here. Senator Metzen, 1106.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committees, Senate File 1106 was brought to me from the Board of Cosmetology. I think it's relatively easy, I hope. First of all, the bill addresses the housekeeping changes.
Senator Metzen, we do have an A1 delete all amendment.
Now, why don't we
put there's an A2.
Yep, there's an A2, and she's passing it up.
Okay. Is this your first committee?
Yes.
Okay. Then Senator A2. Senator Metzen has an A2 amendment.
So moved.
Senator Scalzi moves the A2 delete all authors amendment. Then we can work off the bill as he would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Senator Metzen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I mentioned that this does two things. It addresses housekeeping changes. That is, some of the stuff is outdated and is inconsistent or silent. And the second part of it does away with the sunset on the fees and the inspection fees and the penalties and appropriations that the Cosmetology Board assesses. And I believe the board is willing to increase their fees, which will raise, and they've doing this on their own, so I think that's good that they understand that it's time to probably raise those, and it should raise about another $700,000 for the some badly needed things in the state. So anyway, there's an agreement on that. Subdivision 3, we talk about the ad.
Do you want me to talk about this?
Oh, you want to talk? Why don't you? Okay, yeah. We'll have the witness.
And this is Ms. Strauss.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm working off of the, on lines.
A2.
On line 1.8, we would like to be adding the trunk of the body to the scope of our practice as services are performed in various parts of the trunk of the body. In section 2, what it is doing is it's actually continuing the application fee that's set to sunset on July 1st of 2013. The next section starting at roughly on my line 2.1, it's adding I'd call them on-the-spot fines. We wouldn't be actually collecting money on the spot, but we'd be assessing an invoice for various violations that when they're found, they're either found or not found, and it will assist the board in the complaint docket it currently has, which is over 250 complaints. And several of these violations go through this lengthy complaint legal process when it's essentially either it's a black and white issue, you either have it or you don't have it. And the fees assessed in here are less than what our statutory maximum is, which is $2,000 per violation. Moving down to Section 3, lines 2.34, it's aligning the school licenses to expire on the last day of the initial month of licensure as a salon is. Moving to Subdivision 4, what this is doing is just clarifying that the board is the one to make the decision on the approved providers for theory, practical, and Minnesota laws and rules. Subdivision 10 is clarifying that when someone that has an active license in another state for 3 years or more but has less schooling hours than Minnesota can apply for a reciprocity application without having to go back to school. On line 3.21, this is clarifying that if an applicant's documentation is in a foreign language, that they get them translated into English translations by a board-approved source. The next section, let's see here, subdivision 6, it's deleting that we would inspect prior to the commencing of business because this just simply delays someone opening, and this is all done through the application process in advance. Moving on to section 7, line 4.9, this is clarifying that advanced licenses of school managers and instructors just must maintain their practicing license. So if they ever quit their job as an instructor, they can go back and practice without any penalties. Subdivision 11 is allowing, it's actually increasing instruction to 10 hours per day, where our rules say 8 hours per day. And Subdivision 12 is allowing some online instruction for board-approved theory classes. Section 10 is outlining three different types of prohibited uses, or maybe it's three, which is single-use equipment that if we find single-use, that these are prohibited, which relates back to the penalties in the earlier discussion, as well as Subdivision 2 is skin-cutting equipment that you cannot cut people's skin with various, they're known as credo blades, because that's outside the scope of cosmetology. Subdivision 3 is substances that are not allowed. A liquid monomer is when you applying fake nails. It's a very harsh chemical. It's outlawed in most states, as well as the second one as well. Section 11 is the good cause exemption. A lot of the changes in here will need rule changes to comply with statute, and this is just giving the board the exemption to make this process go quicker. As Senator Metzen was saying, there's an appropriation of $300,000 in each fiscal year of 2013 and 14. The last bit that I skipped, it was also on the first page, is changing the term manicurist, which is an outdated term, to nail technician. And the total, as Senator Metzen was saying, between all the fees would be about $700,000 brought into the board, and the board is asking for $300,000 of it. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Strauss, on page 115, then, I was wondering about that a nail technician manicurist.
Oh, I'm... Yeah.
Did you want to delete the word manicurist then?
Yes.
Or have a comma after nail technician and still keep manicurist?
No, that would be a delete. I apologize.
So move.
Senator Hayden, I was looking at Senator Thompson to do it, though. Senator Hayden moves that on line 115, delete the word manicurist. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Bipartisan, Senator Baptist. I wanted Senator Thompson, but Hayden's fine.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Hayden.
So either Senator Metzen or Ms. Strauss, I was looking for a name.
Strauss.
So in line 1.8, you deleted, you have the whole thing, scalp, face, arms, hands, legs. You struck feet, and then you put trunk of the body. Can you give me some examples of what the trunk of the body would be if you're adding that to the – or are you adding that, or are you just – is that new language?
New language.
Okay. Yeah. Can you tell me a little more about that, Senator Metzen?
Ms. Strauss.
Sure. Chairwoman Pappas and Senator, my version is actually has striking out the word and, A and D, not mm-hmm. feet.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Oh, that's correct.
Okay. And trunk of the body, for instance, there's waxing done on the backs of men and I guess maybe some women. The lower region of both men and women, if you bikini waxes, waxing of all kind is done in the lower regions.
Waxing. Okay. Thank you,
I could have told you that if you'd asked me privately.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
But I've never had it done.
I just thought Senator Metzen might know something about this.
James and I were talking about what that could be. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Metzen, could you tell me why they've asked you to author this bill?
Senator Pappas, it's not because of my success ratio. I don't think so.
Any other questions? I think I had another question. What was it? Oh, I did. Ms. Strauss, on page 414, having just gone through a marathon 12-hour session on Thursday, why would you want to do instruction for 10 hours per student?
Madam Chairwoman and members, this has been actually a request from the school, and it's currently in our rules that it's an 8-hour maximum, and they have actually asked for variances to 10 hours simply because there's a lot of people going back to work or back to school that still need to work. So the schools are aligning 3-day programs at 10 hours. So they're getting 30 hours a week mm-hmm. rather than a typical 40. So instead of taking like 9 months to finish cosmetology school, it might take 12, but they're still able to maintain working, mm-hmm. and that's really what it's accomplishing, and the schools that have it absolutely love it.
Okay. Yes, Senator Hall.
Chair, I'd just like to say this all looks really good. I do have a daughter that is, is not a hairstylist. What do they call it?
Cosmetologist. Oh.
Yeah, something like that. And she makes twice as much money as I've ever made. So they do a good job. She works at Burnsville at a mm-hmm. place called The Fusion. Boy, they really do a great job, and I get free haircuts.
Any other comments or questions from anyone? Motion? Senator Hall.
So moved.
Senator Hall moves that Senate File 1106 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you
very
much.
Why don't we take the other cosmetology bill, as long as we're talking about cosmetology, except Senator Wicklund stepped out.
I'm sure Metzen could
handle it. Oh, it's Senator Johnson. It's Senator Johnson's bill. That's fine.
Good. Members... And Madam Chair and members, House File 770 is also a bill on cosmetology brought to us by the Board of Cosmetology. And basically what the bill is doing is asking for continuing education requirements or putting into place continuing education requirements for cosmetologists, estheticians, which are people who deal with the skin, the salon manager, and others there.
Senator Johnson, I see you have a delete all amendment.
Yes.
So why don't we put that on the bill?
Please, A2 amendment, I would move that.
Senator Johnson moves the A2 amendment to Senate File 770. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Johnson.
Here today with me is Jim Hurst, representing the Board of Cosmetology. We have some cosmetologists here. That are willing to are here to testify. You have in your in your packets. You had a letter from the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association, and also a letter from Jill Hawking, Campus Director for the Minnesota School of Cosmetology, in support of this bill.
And the Minnesota Board of Cosmetology is as well.
Yes, they are supportive of the bill. And I would ask Mr. Hurst to fill you in on the details.
Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst, and I'm here today actually on behalf of the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association. I am not here on behalf of the board. However, the Board of Cosmetology Examiners is supportive of this legislation. Madam Chair and members, the bill before you sets out a very modest approach towards doing a number of things. Number one, it greatly helps the general welfare and safety of our citizens. It also promotes the professionalism of cosmetologists in the state. And by that, what this bill sets out to do is to establish a continuing education program for all cosmetologists in the state. Cosmetologists are licensed on a 3-year cycle. Their license is valid for 3 years. Some cosmetologists may actually hold dual licensure. For example, some may only be estheticians, and others may only be nail technicians. In which case, they would hold one individual license in both categories. What Senate File 770 sets out to do is to focus only on health, safety, and sanitation requirements specific to cosmetologists in the industry. And what it calls for is 3 hours of continuing education within that within a three-year time frame. And if you hold more than one category of license, the continuing education credit could be applied to all licenses that the individual holds. So in other case, they don't have to repeat the same class for multiple licenses. The effective date of this would be, in reality, the 1st of August of next year, 2014, and it would be a condition of relicensure for cosmetologists. So once a cosmetologist after that date had to renew their license, they would have to swear that they had taken 3 hours of continuing education in health, safety, sanitation, as well as 1 hour during that same 3-hour time frame specific to cosmetology rules and law. It's a very modest proposal. It breaks down to being just over 1 hour of continuing education per year on average, and the requirements of the board has been modified so that all they have to do for enforcement is to do a random audit of individuals, at which point, if the individual is selected, they would contact the individual and say, "You've won the lottery," in other words, please provide proof of adherence to the continuing education requirements. If such information is not presented, the board then permissively may take action such as revoking the license, which in practicality would be stating to that individual, go and get your continuing education and maintain it accordingly. That, in essence, is the bill. Members, we have worked very hard at trying to make sure this is not an undue burden on cosmetologists, as well as on the board responsible for enforcing this. With me today are two cosmetologists that would like to testify briefly in support of this measure. I have Mary Reed joining me at this point. And Madam Chair, I could either take questions at this point or wait and defer until the two testifiers have concluded their remarks.
Why don't we hear from Ms. Reed?
Very well.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Again, my name is Mary Reed, and I am salon and barbershop in Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm here in support, of course, of the continuing education bill. I have carried the banner of educator in and out of the field for many years. As early as 1999, I was writing articles relating to cosmetology being the first line of defense in public health, safety, sanitation, and issues related to it. I was the first to develop and have approved by the state cosmetology board a program for professional hair braiders
and have had similar things approved by the state board for professional cosmetologists. I'm very, very serious about quality training. And so in addition to that, I believe most stylists are serious about continuing education, but the quality is what makes this bill different. When you have a bill like this, it will help set an expected standard for the industry, and I think that's very important to revisit, and you can't do that often enough. Also, this will allow some filtering by schools and certain organizations to preview some of the offerings that are out there and partner with the state board in allowing appropriate continuing education credits.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Johnson and testifiers. I know that just kind of in a practical matter, I know that often we have cosmetologists and barbers and others that sometimes have a hard time making their license fee, kind of their annual license fee, and they kind of get thrown into this process of trying to make it up or having to go back to school and just all this kind of things that happen. I guess my concern is how much is this going to cost the individual cosmetologist, or is that going to be prohibitive? And if they don't do it, are we then going to run into this kind of penalty phase that they often run into if they lapse in other ways in their license?
Mr. Hurst?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Hayden. A very good question. The cost for completing a continuing education like this, and again, cosmetologists, their license is every 3 year, not every year. I believe barbers are an annual one, but cosmetologists are 3 years. There are a number of ways to approach this. First of all, professional associations provide ongoing seminars and trade shows, which this could easily be incorporated into that. So if the individual was going to the trade show or the seminar anyway, it would be incorporated into that cost, and we don't foresee the cost being raised specific to including this type of regimen into it. However, one of the things in the bill calls for allowing online education. My analysis suggests that online education specific for this would run maybe $45 to $50. And again, that would be good for a 3 year period. The credits for continuing education, once you receive it, is good for a total of 3 years. So, and that's so that you can apply it to your primary license and then additional licenses if you have such. And those other licenses might come due like the following year. For example, my cosmetology license might be due in 2013. My esthetician license might be due in 2015. But by getting this class and with a 3 year term, it would be good for all of those licenses that are affected.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I was trying to pull the bill. What happens if they don't do it?
If they don't do it, they would be subject to possibly, as I said, winning the lottery by being selected for a random audit. And the state board has indicated to me that they would be prepared to do random audits that would be somewhere in the range of, I believe, close to 100 per month. No more than that. But if the individual was selected and asked to provide evidence that they had done their continuing education and could not because they had failed to do it, it's my understanding that the board would then basically say, okay, we're not mandated to say that you are in violation. We're not mandated to say your license is revoked. We could revoke your license because you said that when you renewed your license that you had done this. In reality, what we would request is that the board simply tell them, go take your continuing education requirements because it's necessary, and that would probably suffice. Again, we want to make this bill very workable. We're not looking to create a hammer to truly penalize individuals, because cosmetologists, while many of them do seek out classes to improve the way they conduct their business, it will be new, and we are informing them appropriately, as would the state board on our website, to make them aware that this requirement is out there.
Mr. Senator Hayden.
Well, no, I was just looking. He was kind of describing. I was trying to look up at the same time. 155A.25. I think the, and I haven't totally gone through, maybe Ms. James can help me, but I guess where I'm concerned is that that this sometimes does become problematic, and then people, you know, they do or they don't get it, they don't finish their CUs or whatever, and then their license is revoked, and now these small business owners are out of work, and, you know, we already have, you know, this 3-year licensing fee that they already have to go through, and I'm just a little concerned, though I think continuing education is important, but I am a little concerned that this could put them into another regulatory fashion in which they ultimately could lose their license and their ability to practice because they didn't, or they weren't able to show proof that they went to continuing education or a trade show or other ways that you suggest, or go online, other ways that you suggest that they could get this CEU done.
Mr. Hurst.
Madam Chair and Senator, again, I want to remind you that on line 2.7 and 2.8, the word is may revoke and may deem them a lapsed practitioner. It does not state that they would be deemed that way. And as far as the online credit hours, we've found that there is a very successful program that can be accessed that way, as well as we've also included independent study, because in case there's someone out there that does not want to do things online or through the internet, and they're not able to attend a show in person, we're prepared to supply them with a videotape and some instruction manuals with a test so they can mail it back to us. So we're trying to cover all options that individuals might be facing.
So do we get an answer in terms of how much these continuing education classes might cost?
Madam Chair, it's our understanding through, if it's either if it's done through an online process, it's about $45 to $50. If it's offered in conjunction with an existing trade show that they're already going to, then it's an added bonus that they get to take the class, and there wouldn't be an extra cost because they're already paying for the trade show.
Ms. Reed, did you want to comment?
I did want to say, Madam Chair, thank you. Mm-hmm. As an owner, for example, this type of course, if I were, it's $45, $50 maximum, and that is one third of what might be charged me if I had a violation. And so I would much rather, as an owner, know, you know, what's current, what it, you know, what I'm supposed to be doing in an approved setting, then have a surprise at the end of the day. So I think it's a wonderful option, and it's more than just, you know, fun. It's really helping the public.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess what I'm hearing is kind of baffling to me. On the one hand, typically when you have continuing education requirements like this, if it's for a lawyer or a physician or whatever, it's that there's some sense that it's important in terms of staying abreast of the latest things that are going on.
The latest styles.
There you go. I believe, sir, in this case, if I correct me if I'm wrong, please, I think you said it's primarily would be directed toward health, safety kinds of thing. Well, if it's important, then why would we not have kind of significant enforcement? If we're kind of not really going to have significant enforcement, is it that important? So I guess I'm a little bit with Senator Hayden here, and don't think we're just trying to keep the cost of our hair care down. That's not true. It seems to me like we want this thing, but we kind of don't want this thing, and it's kind of important, but it's not worth enforcing. It's a little confusing to me.
Mr. Hurst, and then I want to hear from the other testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Thompson. The focus is on health, safety, sanitation, and I agree with you that, you know, there is an argument that says, you know, throw the book at them for not abiding. Because we're just starting to roll this out, I'm satisfied with letting the board make the appropriate decisions where it might be and might not be. And if I could, Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, my next testifier, her statements are even more specific to the points that you brought up. So if I may, I'd like to introduce Susan Mayer at this time to make a few comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Mayer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. My name is Susan Mayer. I've been a cosmetologist for 38 years, and I have owned my own salon for 21. I have served on the Minnesota State Cosmetology Advisory Board and helped with updating and simplifying cosmetology rules and law when our profession was regulated under the Department of Commerce. I also have served as a board member and educator for the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professionals Association and have traveled the state, a volunteer job, by the way, educating our members for free on sanitation, disinfection procedures, and the importance to the public and ourselves in knowing and following the laws and rules. In 2012, there were 55 cease and desist orders executed by the Minnesota Board of Cosmetology Examiners, BEC, for sanitation and disinfection violations for individual licensees, independent and chain, nail and hair salons all over Minnesota. There were 115 violation orders written in all, for all violations, including non-licensure people working. There's estimates of thousands of violations that are caught and corrected every year. In other words, if someone came into the salon, you had something considered minor, maybe dusty dryer filters, you clean that up, you have 10 days to respond, even with pictures, and say that they've been corrected. These violations are really high. It's an epidemic, and it's increasing and alarming. They were improper sanitation and disinfection, storage of products and implements and tools, reuse of porous materials, cabinets and salon furniture dirty and in disrepair, dirty restrooms used for storage, no fire extinguishers or first aid kits, soiled linen everywhere, animals in the salon, and many customer complaints of contracting disease, fungal, and mold infections in salons and pedicures, from pedicures, manicures, whatever. These violations can cause and spread disease, mold, and fungus. Being licensed to perform any cosmetology service in the state of Minnesota carries a huge responsibility. We are licensed to touch you. That's a huge responsibility. Picture this. You're walking down the street. You see a salon. You decide you need a haircut. You enter the salon and see if they take walk-ins. The receptionist says, sure, and within minutes, you're at the shampoo bowl, letting a total stranger touch your head, shampoo, and cut your hair. You are trusting that this person has properly sanitized, disinfected the work area, the shampoo bowl, and the implements used on your service. You are trusting that you will not get HIV, hepatitis C, impetigo, psoriasis, eczema, TB, lice, fungal infection, mold contamination, norwalk, or other noroviruses, Legionnaires' disease, or bacterial or staph infections, or basically the flu. We know what everybody did about the flu. These are just a few of the dangers that hide and have been ignored in an improperly sanitized and disinfected salon. There have been cases of amputated fingers because of fungal infections caused by improperly cleaned nail implements and salons. If you have a regular stylist, you understand the trust and responsibility that comes with that relationship. In my own experience, I have recognized melanoma cancers on the scalp, ears, face, and neck of several clients and referred them to their physicians immediately. I am proud to say they were all caught early enough that they are all still with us. In one case, it could have been a sebaceous cyst on her head. It wasn't. It didn't look right to me. She went to her physician, and it was a rare form of lymphoma that led to the discovery of kidney cancer. It was in early stages, and she lived to be 98. I have chosen this to voluntarily provide myself with this education, and I found this education, by the way, a lot of places free. Sometimes it's even in trade magazines, so just to have it accredited would be great. This keeps my clients, me, and my coworkers safe, healthy, and happy. Not all cosmetologists do this, and I'm proud to say my salon, every time it's been inspected, I've passed with 100%. All licensees are required to be educated in cosmetology school to recognize and deal with disorders and diseases of the scalp, head, arm, face, nails, feet, and hopefully the trunk of the body in order to test for licensure. We are trained in school to know that what we can and cannot touch and when certain diseases and conditions need to be referred to a physician. Times and conditions change, so do the procedures. New diseases appear, new disinfection and sanitation methods are invented. There needs to be a continuing education requirement put into law that will keep cosmetology licensees updated on these changing things. To protect the public and the workers themselves, this is a must. There are approximately 6,000 licensed salons in Minnesota and approximately 25,000 licensed individuals. The most efficient way and effective way to accomplish this goal for safety for this many licensees is to require continuing education on sanitation, disinfection, disease, rules, and laws as a part of retaining your licensure to touch people.
Ms. Mayor, I imagine there's a fair amount of this training that goes on during this instruction that goes on during their initial training period.
Yes, Madam Chair. Right. It's extensive.
But do you think that, you know, we're always discovering new things about infections?
Back 38 years ago, there was no norovirus. There was no bad chemicals that we found later we shouldn't be using. Mm-hmm. We were putting formaldehyde in our drawers to do sanitation and disinfection. Had I not voluntarily gone to classes and kept updated as a professional, I wouldn't have known it. That's lethal stuff. Mm-hmm. Now we use an EPA-approved tuberculocidal agent to disinfect all combs, metal implements after washing them with water and soap. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that have changed since we started out. It's just look at the cruise ships, you know, or some of the schools. There was a school, I believe, in Chaska that had 80 children sick. They closed it for 3 days to disinfect the school. The public doesn't think about that when they go into a salon. They have no clue what could happen unless it's happened to them.
Right.
And our industry's been so on top of it for so long, and all of a sudden it doesn't feel like that anymore. I just think it's very important that it's part of their relicensure. If they care about you as clients and themselves and their workers or their employees, then 4 hours in years. 3 years, that's they spend more time than that reading a People magazine.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I mean, so after that testimony, it sounds like this bill doesn't go far enough, right? If we were to if we were to listen to Ms. Mayor, what you said about, and on a more serious note, I do think along with Senator Thompson, this kind of random inspection process of did you get your 4 hours in any number of ways that you could potentially get it. I mean, based on your testimony, Ms. Meyer, it sounds like it needs to have a much more thorough a process that says that each and every year before you, or each every 3 years before you get your license, you should show that you have taken the prescribed amount of courses that you think or that your industry thinks is important to keep people away from these litany of things that you just described could potentially happen to someone by just going to get their hair cut. So I'm also now starting to try to figure out what are we really trying to do here. Are we just kind of throwing something to see if it works, or are we really concerned that people are getting really, really sick in these environments and that we really need to ensure that before people get their license that they can show that they've gone through the prescribed amount of training or continuing education training to make sure that they're not making the public sick.
Senator Hayden, I tend to believe that people are mostly law-abiding, so that if you do have a requirement that, you know, most people will do it subject to random audits. So I would hate to make this more bureaucratic than it is. Just an example, I did the original bill licensing tanning salons, and we had no inspection whatsoever, unless the local government did it. And you know, but everybody did it. They changed their bulbs. They cleaned their tables. You know, they did what they were supposed to do just because Minnesotans are just law-abiding. I had a question about...
Let's go home.
Yeah, well.
I have a question about Section 3. Why do you need Senator Johnson or Mr. Hurst or whoever wants to answer it, Ms. Mayor, why do you need expedited rulemaking authority? for this?
Madam Chair, I'll let Mr. Hurst talk about that one.
Madam Chair, this was requested by the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners. This saves them a tremendous amount of money as opposed to going through the traditional rulemaking process. It's my understanding going this route costs the State Board about $500 as opposed to, I think, $20,000 to do a full-fledged rule.
Since it's just for the continuing
and
education.
And it's just focused on this aspect, correct.
Any other discussions on the bill? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In line 1.10 through 1.11, it talks about individual cosmetologist, nail technician, esthetician.
That's a, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, that is a person who deals with the skin. That would be.
Okay. Madam Chair, so these people here, are any of these people considered instructors? Could they be an instructor being a cosmetologist or a nail technician or someone who's a salon manager? Could they instruct for this continuing education or anything like that?
Mr. Hurst.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, yes, they could be instructors. Instructors are the only category of in cosmetology that does have a continuing education requirement, and that requirement is 45 hours per 3 years. And within this section at the very end, there is on line 1.22, it specifically says the subdivision does not apply to instructors simply because if they're already taking 45 hours, we don't find it necessary to add another 4 hours on top of that requirement.
Is there a separate instructor license?
There is, correct.
Right, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to that, where you said it does not apply to instructors or inactive licenses, if they, say, come back and want to get their license, if they've missed, say they've been out of practice for 6 years.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, there is a category of inactive licenses, and those are individuals who have decided to just walk away, but they still want to somewhat keep a license, but that license is inactive. They cannot perform any services on anyone, but there is a separate part of law that for an inactive license holder, if they choose to return, they have to take, Susan, help me out.
It's what? 40-hour refresher course.
40-hour refresher course specific. Then once their license would be activated, then the next time they went to renew, then they would have to abide by the continuing education.
Okay, Senator Thompson, then I think we should vote.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
For the final word.
I just want to clarify, I'm with you, Senator Pappas. This is Minnesota where all citizens obey the law above average. So we're, I don't think we, my point was
I
not
think
you're to Senator.
Use that against me sometime, though.
What's that? Well, I would never do that. I guess I'm not with Senator Hayden on this one, that I want to see it be more restrictive. My concern is that it gets more and more burdensome. And I didn't get all your statistics written down on the violations. I think you said 55 cease and desist orders. I'm thinking that the violations out there relative to the number of people in this business and the number of folks that are served, very small. So I have a hard time seeing this as epidemic. My point wasn't that I think we should have stricter enforcement. My question is whether we should really impose this upon people at all. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Mayor.
Madam Chair, and committee, part of it is with a lot of people moving to this state, some of whom don't speak English, sometimes don't always jump to know the laws. So by having a uniform requirement for that, that would help a lot. And as far as it being burdensome, to when you take your course, and I'm imagining it's the same way when the instructors reapply for their licenses, you give proof with your renewal. They can choose to check your proof or not. So it's not like you just totally just go all Minnesotan on it. You have to show some proof, and it's like when you used to have to write your license, your insurance number on your driver's license that they never checked to get your tabs.
Okay, Do we have Senator Johnson can make her own motion.
Madam Chair, I would just say that I think we should be happy and pleased that the industry is policing themselves and trying to improve the situation for all of us. And definitely health and safety is a problem when we go into salons for that care. So with that, I would move the bill and as amended and refer to finance.
Senator Johnson moves that 770 as amended be recommended pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Dibble.
Thank you.
And we have an amendment.
I move the amendment, if you can call me when.
We don't have it passed out yet, but I'll call on you. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dibble. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I have Senate File 446. What Senate File 446 seeks to accomplish is establishing a statewide school employees' health insurance program.
And the issue before our jurisdiction is related to this amendment, Section 5, the creation of a labor management committee.
Correct, Madam Chair. And so we have the A11 amendment that's being passed around that would replace the language in Section 2 and would put the details of the establishment of the Labor Management Committee before you in the form and manner that this committee likes.
Okay, why don't you just explain then the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Labor Management Committee is established for the purpose that you can read down in the Subdivision 7 and Subdivision 8 to study issues relating to the insurance program, including but not limited to flexible benefits, utilization review, quality assessment, cost efficiency, and probably most importantly, the commissioner will work with this group on major decisions that affect the program, and they mutually agree on those design changes. The Labor Management Committee would consist of 7 members of management, 4 from the school boards, 1 from the Superintendents Association, and 2 from the Principals Associations, mm-hmm. and then 7 members who represent school employees. So that would be the labor side of labor management, 4 appointed by Education Minnesota, and then 1 each by SEIU, AFSCME, and the School Employees Association. And then the terms are set forth for 4 years, the date upon which they're first appointed, the length of their terms, how vacancies are filled, Subdivision 4, when the first meeting needs to be called by January 15th of 2014, called by one of the appointees of the School Board Association, the chairmanship selection from its own members, and then how expense and reimbursement matters are handled, Madam Chair.
And Ms.
And their reporting requirements and the sunset when the program no longer operates, which hopefully would be never.
It's funny language. And then the repealer is the section that's in the bill because we're replacing the language of on page 5 of the bill. Oh, line 2.20, sorry. We're replacing the language on 2.20 in the bill with this amendment.
Yep. Correct.
All right. And Ms. James, does this amendment adhere to the committee guidelines for creation of an advisory committee?
Madam Chair and members, I believe this amendment makes it meet the guidelines.
Okay, thank you. Then we're just taking testimony in relation to the Labor Management Committee, and so I'm not sure if people who signed up to testify still want to testify. Ann? Nope. Okay. Is there anyone who wants to testify? Okay. Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, do you want to move the amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Torres Ray moves the A11 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Ms. Kelleher, why don't you introduce yourself for the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We're here today to share a couple concerns we have about this labor management board for statewide school employees. Our first concern is that 4 out of the 10 representatives will be employees of some nature and receiving their health care through this board. We are concerned about this board if it should be split on a 7-7. There's not additional language that's been in past bills about how to handle a tie vote or how do you make deciding votes. And it doesn't actually clarify either what would happen if the commissioner and the committee don't mutually agree on a plan design. And we'd appreciate those two. Since school districts don't have the ability to levy for additional health insurance cost increases, we would think that having a management, a balanced board would be beneficial to the state as well as to the kids of Minnesota. Last but not least, Madam Chairman, we're interested if you want to pick up, and I'll leave this with Senator Dibble for him to review. 471-6161, it's a piece dealing with group insurance through governmental units. Subdivision 5, specifically in collective bargaining, it talks about the aggregate value of benefits, and it goes to this statement, collective agreements should not be reduced. And our concern is if there are only 4 plans out there, we have employees all over the state, that might be creating an additional burden across school districts. So I'll leave this with Senator Dibble, and as he goes forward, he can feel how this should be picked up.
So, Ms. Kelleher, in terms of the Labor Management Committee, I think you bring up a good point about 14. So, Senator Dibble, you might want to think about, do you want to go up to 15 or down to 13 to avoid a tie, or what would you do in case of a tie? Ms. Kelleher, what was your second point?
Madam Chairman, basically what would happen if the commissioner and the committee do not agree on, mutually agree on a plan design?
Who is the commissioner? Commissioner of Education?
It would be the commissioner of management and budget.
Commissioner of management.
Who has authority over the public employees insurance plan, CGIP as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. If they do not agree on the design. That's you're talking about subdivision 8? Must mutually agree to all plan design changes. So what happens if they don't agree? And what was your third thing?
Madam Chairman, it was the 4 out of 10 of the makeup of the board. And last but not least, I want to give you the site. It's 471.6161 on group insurance governmental units, subdivision 5 in particular there. That does not allow schools or local governments to diminish the aggregate value of benefits. And the word in the statute is shall not be reduced. And so we either, you know, some kind of incorporation of this statute into this bill at some point as it moves forward would be important.
That last thing maybe could be fixed in finance with a notwithstanding language, blah, blah, blah. But we could focus on dealing with these other issues. So while we're thinking about the tie vote and what if they don't agree, I wanted you to repeat for me once again, I'm sorry I'm feeling dense, about what you meant about the 4 out of 10, because there's 14 people on the committee. And what was your 4 out of 10? Deal.
Madam Chairman and members, it's been a long day for all of us.
Oh, it's only Monday.
It is only Monday. Madam Chairman, 4 of those members are elected local government officials, school board members who are charged and take an oath of office to manage the school district.
Okay, I'm not understanding where the 4 is and the 10.
4 appointed by the School Boards Association.
1.10.
1.10, okay.
And then it
4 appointed. I got it now.
All right.
Okay. By the Minnesota School Boards Association. Okay. And then you're concerned about the other 10.
Correct, Madam Chairman. Right. They are all
so
employees.
We're saying this is only 4 out of the 14.
Right.
Right. I got it now.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, you know, as I look at that, I think, as having sat on many labor management committee meetings, that is really administrators and employees. And then I think about the sheer numbers of who's in my building. Let's see, 80 teachers and, I don't know, 7, 8 administrators. So I think I don't see this also as this group that wants to butt heads. I see this as a group that wants to do a plan that's going to work for both sides. So I don't see this as adversarial. I think that it's something that can work, and I certainly, when I define labor management, I really think of the people that are clearly spelled out in this particular this bill.
And it seems to me that if they have a tie or they don't mutually agree, then they can't move forward. So it really is actually forcing them to have much more of a consensus, or at least a supermajority.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
So I support what Senator Dahl just said, and I think that was our goal, labor management. And I don't think anyone can argue that superintendents, principals, et cetera, are not management.
Right.
As far as the tie, I was going to make the point you just made, so thank you. You're very good at reading my mind. Would suggest if we have to, we could introduce the idea of, you know, mediation or conflict resolution process to break impasse in those instances.
Senator Dahl.
Ms. Kelleher, could you explain to me again?
Sorry.
What did you say?
I said Dahl. Senator Hall.
That's right. That's right. We look close. I hope I'm not offending you, Senator Dahl. Ms. Kelleher, could you explain again why you think that that wouldn't be proper, fair, whatever? Why do the principals not? Why are they not the same thing as employee? They are employee, is it that they get employee benefits the same? That they're asked? It's not a management employee because they're all getting the same thing. How does that work,
Ms. Kelleher?
Madam Chairman and Senator Hall, I think you bring up a good point. School districts are not allowed, local government officials aren't allowed to levy for this. So it matters in that you've got to make the school district work with what's been given to you and what you folks decide going forward. In that venue, the school board members aren't personally invested into the health insurance. And the employees are, from the superintendent down all the way through, receive health insurance benefits from this committee. So I think you need a balance going forward of trying to provide the best possible program in the most efficient way possible.
Madam Chair?
I think my school board members get health benefits in the school district. Senator Hall.
I would like to move the A14 amendment on that note.
The A14 amendment will be passed out. Senator Hall?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A14 amendment, I think, brings up a point that was talked about earlier in the Hoffman Senate File 640, where there's vested interests. And basically, this amendment just says that we would give MSBA 7 members on the board, and we would then be assured that they wouldn't have any vested interest. And then it'd be, I think, much more proper, much more fair.
So you're eliminating the school administrators and the elementary school principals and the secondary school principals association and having the school board pick up those three other appointees.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Well, two points, Madam Chair. One is in some instances, school board members are beneficiaries of these of the plans, and I don't think they would be barred from that. Second of all, you know, I think you know, Senator Dahl made the point better than I could, more eloquently than I could. This is a labor management committee, and the management side is composed of managers. I mean, if I think the unarticulated fear is that somehow the superintendents and the principals are going to side with the teachers against the school board members, and I just don't anticipate that happening. I think there's a pretty clear distinction. This is a labor management committee, and we have representatives of management and representatives of labor.
Any other comments,
Senator Hall? Chair.
Madam Chair, I'll also just say for the record that this amendment was offered at the last committee and was defeated, and I extended an invitation for further conversation to the stakeholder groups. I don't have time to chase folks down and have received no calls and no visits to my office on this subject or to have this discussion.
Okay, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think when a stakeholder has a real concern here, and it's been, like say, in the other committee, and I think there are times when some of the principals, I would assume, that even have their teacher's license, they get a benefit out of it. And so I would move the A14 and ask for roll call.
Senator, roll call has been requested. Senator Dahl?
I have no comment at this time.
Okay. Then the clerk will take the roll on the A14 amendment.
Pappas?
No.
Eaton?
No.
Hall?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Dahl?
No.
Hayden?
No.
Housley?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Peterson? Scalzi?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
Torres Ray?
No.
Wicklund?
No.
On a 4-8 vote, the 4 yes and 8 no, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, are we ready to move on? Is there a motion?
Chair?
Yes, Senator
Hall. I'd like to move the A13 amendment.
Pass up the A13 amendment.
There's not any more.
So while it's being passed out, it's a pretty simple amendment. Why don't you go ahead and explain it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment does a similar approach, except on this amendment, it adds, instead of the MSBA, one of those members, one of the three members, would be the Association of School Business Officials. One would... I'm sorry. 12. I'm looking at this again. One would be, my understanding would, one would be the human resource person, and then a supervisor from MASA. So you've got the MASBO, human resource, and the MASA.
So you still have the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, but you delete the elementary school and the secondary school principals, and you insert someone from the Association of School Business Officials and a human resource director employed by a school district who would
Correct.
Be appointed by who? Because everyone else chooses their own appointee, right? So you'd have to figure out who that one human resource director is going to be appointed by.
Maybe MSB appointee.
MSBA.
What's MSB? Oh.
School board, yeah, MSBA.
Okay. Okay. Any discussion on the amendment, Senator Dibble?
Madam Chair, I'm a very reasonable guy, and I am. I'm not being sarcastic or flip. I have asked the School Boards Association and others to come and talk to me about their ideas for how to compose this labor management committee. This is an important discussion. And this might be something that I'm agreeable to, but we've had no benefit of discussion, and I'm frankly disappointed to see this amendment pop out from Senator Hall here in this setting. I issued the invitation quite publicly at the last committee hearing to have this discussion, and this is, along the lines of what I'm thinking, but I would have appreciated the benefit of some opportunity to think through what makes sense. Labor management committees are not an exercise in fun. They're important committees that make important decisions, and we need to think hard about them. This is along the lines. I don't think it's quite exactly what I had in mind. So, Madam Chair, I'm at this point not willing to accept this amendment, but I would again issue publicly the invitation for folks to come find me and sit down with me for a half hour, an hour, and talk about this.
It does seem to me that the in the existing bill, the elementary school principals and the secondary school principals, well, maybe not. You have to be a principal then, not a business official. Never mind. Okay, any other? Yes, Senator Hall.
And I would just like to respond to Senator Dibble. I think, Senator, you understand that a lot of times we're almost shooting from our hip when we're going from committee to committee. And I was just looking at this a half hour before the committee opened up and was given some thoughts on it and thought they were reasonable. So I'm a little surprised that you would jump on me in any sense, because I think you understand how this all works. I don't know whether the School Board Association's been able to talk with you, and I know you're a busy man, too, with a lot of bills going on. So I try to be understanding there. I think this is reasonable. It isn't, of course, what I completely would like, but or I think what the School Board maybe Association would like, but I think it's reasonable, and I would like a roll call vote.
Roll call's been requested. The secretary will take the roll.
Pappas?
No.
Eaton?
No.
Hall?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Dahl?
No.
Hayden?
No.
Housley?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Peterson? Scalzi?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
Torres Ray?
No.
Wicklund?
There being 4 in favor, 8 opposed, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Okay.
So, Madam President,
yes.
I'll just say that I'm very pleased that the School Board Association knows how to find Senator Hall and speak with him, and that's great. They know where my office is as well.
Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate Bill number 446, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those
in favor. Have a roll call vote, ma'am.
Roll call has been requested.
Sure.
The secretary will take the roll on the amendment on the motion.
Pappas?
Yes.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden?
Yes.
Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson? Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wicklund?
There being 8 in favor and no opposed, 4 opposed, the motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is passed and sent to the Finance Committee. Okay, there being no further business before the committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.